All right, so here's some references that deal with things related to the local trace formula. Harishchandra did a lot of things in harmonic analysis that are very closely tied to the local trace formula. In some way, the local trace formula maybe organizes those things in a better way, plus it brought in some new ingredients. Well, weighted orbital integrals actually preceded the local trace formula, but you don't find the weighted orbital integrals in Harishchandra, but nevertheless, you find many of the same things. And so I especially want to mention, as things closely related to stuff in this course, the very first one, the old Springer lecture notes, 162 in 1970, and also the two of them with the same title, Admissible Invariant Distributions on Reductive Piatic Groups in the Queen's Papers. That was the that's kind of a short version, and then an expanded version appears here in these University Lecture Series 1999. Those are the two most closely related to things we're talking about. And there's just, sorry? On the, they will be. What do you mean, in my notes? Yes, they will be. They will be, yes. They'll be in today's. All right, we were discussing the case of PGL2. All right, we have some kind of local trace formula on the Lie algebra in general, but there's a key quantity you have to calculate, and we worked out what it was. It's the thing we're calling U, little u. Let me just recall what came out of that calculation. That was the thing we did using the tree. All right, and okay, so G is PGL2. Then we've got our split torus, which in this case is diagonal, and to eliminate, to sort of get rid of the center in a convenient way, I think of it as being represented by those matrices. We have this system where if we have group elements G and H, then we use them to get vertices in the tree. So we put X, by definition, it's the transform of the base vertex by G, and Y is the transform of the base vertex by H. And then we have this picture where here's the standard apartment. And then the quantity that really matters is how far these vertices are from the apartment. And we call the distance from X to the apartment d of X. And of course, you also have d of Y. And those quantities enter into this formula that we had. And here's the formula. The factor that occurs, sort of the interesting new factor that occurs in the local trace formula was this U sub A. Depends on these two group elements, H and G, and then the value will depend upon those points, X and Y, obtained from G and H. T is the truncation parameter. In this case, it's just a non-negative integer. And the interpretation was it was a sort of a distance in the building that you work with. Anyway, the value we calculated came in two parts. One is a nice explicit formula, 1 plus twice. Then you take this integer t and subtract from it both d of x and d of y. That's in the case where t is bigger than or equal to d of x plus d of y. And then, well, we don't really have to care exactly, but we should keep track of the fact that we get something which is in the range between 0 and 1 otherwise. So it's small, and we can deal with that uncertainty. It won't actually matter. Then the main thing to think was, well, this truncation was forced on us to make things converge, but we want to think of t as being very, very big. I mean, we would have liked to have taken t to be plus infinity, but we can't do it. But you think of t as being very big, and that means when we have a particular g and h, and therefore a particular x and y, and we let T vary, when T gets big enough, we're going to be in this good case where T is bigger than these. All right, so when T is big, you're going to be in this first case, and we won't have to worry about this annoying case down here. Of course, the trouble is how big you have to take T depends on the X and Y, and there are, of course, there are X's and Y's which are arbitrarily far from the apartment, and therefore you can't find a T that's big enough to work for all X's and Y's at once, that's for sure, but still, it's okay. I mean, we'll see how things go. And in a sense, we will sort of let T get big. And here's the precise version. We'll simply make a definition. We'll write down a quantity which is quite analogous to this, and it'll just be, by definition, the good thing, and just ignore the bad thing. In all cases, it'll just be the first thing. All right, so the definition. And this one makes sense for any real T. Before, in order to make sense out of things, it really it was better to have it be an integer. But for T and R, we just put the, now it's a V, so you have to pay attention whether I'm writing a U or a V. I'll try to make them look very different. But V is just that thing there. One, just copy it, one plus twice. Period. Now, that handles this split torus. Of course, in PGL2, you just have the two alternatives. Either thing's split or it's compact. I'm also using the word elliptic for those compact ones. In general, elliptic means compact mod the center, but here the center is trivial, so it just means compact. Suppose now that T is elliptic, i.e. compact. When we go through our recipe, the biggest split torus in T is then trivial. And then the next step was you associated to it a Levy subgroup. Well, M is the centralizer of AT, but that's trivial, and so the centralizer is all of G. All right, so that's just saying that in this case, if it's elliptic, the smallest Levy subgroup containing it is actually the whole group. You can't find, it's not contained in any proper Levies, just in the whole thing. Anyway, In the general version, you have a U sub M for each M, and again, we will have a V sub M for every M. Here it's A, and now I want also the definition of the other case, so V G. For PGL2, that's all M can be. It's supposed to be a Levy subgroup containing A, and there's just two alternatives, either A or G. V G of something, H comma G T. Well, again, it's what, I guess I didn't write it over here, but we have also the UG. Maybe I should fit that in too. UG of HGT, you have to work through the definitions, but in this case, no integration occurs. In the definition of this thing that occurred in the local trace formula, there was an integration over the split part of T. And if you're in the case where the split part of T is trivial, there's no integration, and just nothing happens. And rather than having an integral involving H inverse AG, the A isn't there, you just have the value of the characteristic function that we started with in the beginning, which was U. That was our original characteristic function that we used to truncate, and we just have H inverse G. And now you can say the same thing. This guy here, well, maybe I should expand it out. This is, again, because it's a characteristic function, it's going to be either 1 or 0. And you can think about how it goes. It's very easy. It's 1 if the distance from x to y, x and y have the same meaning, if the distance from x to y is less than or equal to t, and it's equal to 0 otherwise. Okay, so the truncation has a very simple effect in the case when you're dealing with an elliptic torus. The only effect of the truncation is sometimes you have 1, that's when T is big enough, bigger than the distance from X to Y, otherwise you get 0. But anyway, again, think of what happens when T gets big, then we're in the simple case here, and we just get 1, all right? And that's why we're using the 1 here. That's what happens when T is big in the elliptic case. So it's all completely reasonable. What we're doing is replacing these awkward things by what they become when T is big. All right, let me write that down. So then, for M equal to either A or G, we have, in either case, when we look at this new thing, V, it's actually the same as the old thing when T is big enough. But as I've already said, how big T has to be depends on H and G. Well, in particular, of course, a trivial consequence of this, but I will write it sort of, because this is the way you're going to use the Lebesgue-dominated convergence theorem. It's actually important to consider the difference. So let me just take the difference. The difference then, well, as a trivial consequence, it goes to zero as T goes to infinity. All right, I'm not saying anything non-trivial there. It actually becomes zero identically when T gets close to infinity, but it goes to zero. So we'll be in a situation where we have pointwise convergence of some functions to the function that's identically zero. To apply Lebesgue-dominated convergence theorem, we need some kind of estimate that applies to all those things as T varies. And for that purpose, we need to make note of the following thing. In Lebesgue-dominated convergence theorem, you replace things by their absolute values and see if you can get a uniform estimate. Well, let's look at the difference between these quantities. Take its absolute value. Just look, look back at what they are, and you see easily that we get the following estimates. In the case when M is G, well, I mean, that one's really clear. And the other one, you have to think for a little bit to see that this question mark doesn't cause any trouble, but it's very small, so it won't. And you definitely get this estimate. It's no worse than twice d of x plus d of y. The next step in the local trace formula is to simply write down expressions that are exactly the same as the ones we had before, but in which you simply replace u by v in all the terms. All right, so we modify. So we're changing both the left and right side of the local trace formula. And they really do change. But the new guys will still be equal to each other. So they'll still have an equality. Left-hand side equals right-hand side. Modify KT. Yeah. We need some. Well, we can maybe we can discuss after what you need, but I don't think so. No. This is not enough. No. Later on. No. We will get to. No. This is just a trivial observation. The hard part is later. But I'm just saving this for later use. All right, so the question was, is this enough to justify the replacing of the one by the other? The answer is no, but it's needed, and then something else is also needed. And we'll see that in a minute. I just wanted to state this while we had it had these quantities on the board. Okay, we're going to modify this thing getting the new version. And this replacement, it just involves, as I just said, it revolves replacing u sub m gets replaced by v sub m. Otherwise, everything stays the same. Let me write down what then results. You just take what we had before for k and just change that one thing. But probably I should write on the board because I don't have k on the board. So if you've forgotten what k is, well, just undo it. Take this thing and change it back to u. All right, so this is a definition. We just define this thing. in this way. That's a sum, again, same convention. That's really a sum over conjugacy classes. And it's a finite sum. I don't know if I said that, but there's just finitely many conjugacy classes. So there's no, that sum won't cause any trouble as far as convergence. Okay, so far everything is just the same. Well, still the same. Well, as usual in this theory, there's not enough room on a blackboard to contain the formulas. Okay, and usual thing, M, as I've already reviewed, is the centralizer of the split component of T. All right, so there's our V, replacing the U we had before. Now, in order to work with this thing, for example, we have to give some argument now to say why this converges. It's no longer clear. Before we arrived at the other thing, the one that had the U sub M in it, we arrived at it by a process of, you know, manipulating things. But we started with something that was convergent in the best possible way, and everything after that was guaranteed to be convergent. Here we've modified it. The thing we changed is not much different, so you would think it should still converge. But unfortunately, you can't just reason in some... you actually have to just justify it from scratch somehow. Where? No, the AG somehow disappeared somewhere in the process of getting the U sub M last time. We did something, integration in stages at some point, and exactly changed over there. Yeah. Okay, so we don't see A sub G anywhere anymore. In an early phase, we had A sub G somewhere, but it's gone by now. Okay, so we need some useful facts that will let us, for example, see that this thing makes sense. And also, we need enough in order to prove that this guy stays the same when we replace F1 by its Fourier transform F hat and F2 by F2 check. Okay, that's what would have been true with the K, but now we have to reason somehow that it's still true with the J, even though we've changed it. So we need something to be able to justify all these things. So these are useful facts, I'll just say it that way. In these facts, we're dealing with some function on the Lie algebra. And the first fact, tells us about the nature of the functions we have to integrate over the torus, over the Cartan subalgebra, rather. We want to know we have to understand this portion of the integral. So let's see what kind of things arise. And I'm going to simplify things. It's enough to consider the following thing. Now we just have one single function. All right, so we're on some Cartan subalgebra and looking at regular guys H in there. And let's define a function just by putting in our discriminant factor to the 1/2 power. I mean, the reason why 1/2 looks reasonable from this point of view is that we need to divide that thing up as the square root of it times the square root of it and put one of them with the F1 and one of them with the F2. But also just for this result to be correct, we need it with the 1/2. It's somehow exactly the right thing. Then we have our orbital integral, like so. All right, so we're, like we did with Schleicha germs, we're thinking about orbital integrals for a variable element in the Cartan subalgebra, just thinking of what we get as a function on the Cartan subalgebra, but we renormalize it using the discriminant factor, or rather the square root of it. And then we have a bunch of information about what this function looks like. It's locally constant as a function on this regular set. So here's the list of properties of this thing. It's locally constant on T regular. It's bounded that's the hardest part. Yeah. That's in the Lie algebra, and it's an open subset of... Okay, so the question is, what's the topology on T regular? We have T. T is just a vector space over a p-adic field, and so it's just a product of copies of F. It has a topology. And the regular set is open in there. And so just it inherits a topology. Just an open, it's a nice open subset of a T. It's bounded, and this is non-trivial. I think there's a proof in Harish-Chandra. It's maybe a bit more complicated than necessary because he was probably thinking back to how he had done things in the real case. In the p-adic case, if you arrange things in the right way with the Schleicher germs, it's not too difficult. You can you have to do something with the Schleicher germs called semi-simple descent and study what happens for a while, and you can prove this boundedness. Anyway, I'm going to skip it. It's just for us, it'll be just a fact. Sorry? Well, when I think about it as a function on T, I'm just going to extend it by zero because we don't really have any natural values for it except on the regular set. But if I regard it as a function of T, of every point in T, I'll just extend it by zero. And then, of course, boundedness doesn't change. Then the last thing is it's compactly supported on T. And here there's a fine point. I'm not saying it's compactly supported on T regular. That would be a much stronger statement, which is false. It's compactly supported on T. In other words, you're in this vector space T, and if you get outside some huge ball, the thing is zero. But I'm not saying anything about what happens near zero. If it was compactly supported on T regular, for instance, then it would be zero away from some little neighborhood of the origin. I'm not saying that. It's a compactly supported on T. Okay, those are the properties that we'll need there. And then, second fact, I would find it harder to give a precise reference for this. It's I think you could accurately say that it's more or less in Harish-Chandra, or and it's certainly spelled out in Vols-Verger, for example, the reference I gave before. Similar things on the group are undoubtedly in Arthur. So it, I don't know, but it's harder to give a precise reference for it. And the fact, this one I will just formulate for PGL2 because we don't have the whole theory developed yet. That other one made sense on any group and is true on any group. This one, because I haven't discussed these weighting factors on an arbitrary group, we only have this kind of weighting factor that's appearing here for this specific case. I can only formulate it for this group. But, okay, do the usual thing. And then we have, you know, G... I'm going to use the usual things. G, X, all those quantities are as before. D of X represents the distance to the apartment. Then if we look at the following thing, oh, sorry, before I do this, I want to come back to here. In the first fact, notice that there's a consequence of this. If we integrate this expression here, this function that we were talking about, if we just integrate it over all of the Cartan subalgebra T, that makes sense. It's an L1 function. So this these things imply it's an L1 function on T. We can just integrate over T without any worries. Now, in this case here, I want to say something similar, but it just applies to the split torus, where something non-trivial happens. Namely, we have these weighting functions to contend with. Otherwise, it's the same. All right, so if I stopped right here, we would know that this integral is convergent by this fact number one, if we just stopped there. But now we're going to make it worse, we're going to make it bigger, by multiplying in this weighting factor, d of x, where x is obtained for from g in this way, and integrate over the whole Cartan subalgebra. Fact number two is that this still converges, even though it's gotten worse, but it still converges. Integrand still is L1 function on T. Well, I mean, whatever. That integral, no, it's not T, it's Lie algebra of A. All right, so I don't think I worded it especially well, but do the integral, that gives you a function on the Cartan subalgebra, and then it's an L1 function. Now, some things to note. These facts one and two, they take care of our question that was unclear until now, namely, why does this stuff still converge after we've replaced U by V? You have to look back at the formula for V. V involves, well, we're discussing the convergence of that thing for some fixed value of T. For every truncation parameter, we get something. But the convergence question has to do with fixing a value of T. When you fix a value of T, you have 1 plus twice T. That's a constant. You have 2 times d of x, you have 2 times d of y. All right, and so when you have to go back and look at see what's happening here, but these convergence facts are enough. When you just think it through, there's nothing non-trivial is going on here. So facts 1 and 2 just imply immediately that the double integrals that we have converge. Double integrals in j, t do converge. All right, so that's not a problem. Another thing, of course, the kind of reasoning you do, definition? Yeah. The kind of reasoning you do to justify that, as you see from the form of fact one and fact two, you justify the convergence of the individual pieces. We can justify convergence with this constant, with this individual d of x, with this individual d of y. And because of that, it means that this function now actually let t vary. We have a well-defined quantity here. It does make sense. And as you let t vary, you see how is it varying? I mean, it's only varying here in this thing that depends linearly on t. And so for sure, as a function of t, this is actually just a linear function for fixed functions f1 and f2. So for fixed f1 and f2, t, the function t goes to j upper t of f1, f2, it's obvious, is linear. I.e., linear in the broad sense of the form a plus bt. Maybe affine linear or something. I forget what the right words are. And then another thing, this is the part where you apply the dominated convergence theorem. I'll let you think about how that goes, but let me give a kind of short version of it. I want to argue that when we look at the difference between these two things, k, that's the old one. That was the thing that we actually had the other day, I guess just yesterday. Let's take the difference of the old one and the new one. Well, of course, they both have exactly the same form. So you can just take the difference term by term. And what that will amount to doing is we'll have a new collection of double integrals, but right here we'll have u sub m minus v sub m. All right, that's what's going on. And we've already discussed a little bit U sub m minus V sub m, and it was dominated, as in the dominated conversion, it's dominated by something very reasonable of the kind that we're able to estimate because of facts 1 and fact 2. All right, so it's dominated by stuff that we can handle. That's all right. And point-wise, what happens is that as t goes to infinity, the integrands become the same. In other words, the difference goes to 0. All right, so this thing goes to 0 as t goes to plus infinity. And this is dominated convergence theorem. Well, now we're in a position to show that we still do have a trace formula. Namely, we do have an equality between J and J with the functions replaced by their Fourier transforms. We know that that's true for K. That came just because that's how we constructed things. But now we get a non-obvious thing that uses these facts here. I'll call it a proposition. It's still not quite the theorem, but it's very close to it in this case. And the proposition says we still have a local trace formula for these new quantities, J, that are different from before. In other words, we have this equality here. If you replace, and you have to replace by the Fourier transform just like before. Take the Fourier transform with psi here and take the Fourier transform with psi inverse there. That's the inverse Fourier transform. And this statement is valid for any. Now it's true for any real number. It doesn't even have to be positive anymore. Because the thing is, what we saw in part B here was as a function of t, it's just a linear function. And so somehow the equality actually will become valid even for negative values of t. And we will use that. In a second, we will take a negative value of t. Proof. Well, consider the difference of the two sides. All right, we want to show that the left-hand side minus the right-hand side is 0, and what do we know about it? On the one hand, by note part B, we know that the difference is again linear. So B tells us is a linear function of t in the same sense, affine linear. And then C, which says that the difference between K and J goes to 0 as T goes to plus infinity, that tells us that, this plus the, remember, we do have this. Our old crude version of the local trace formula was this equality here. And remember, that was easy. It just came from the fact that we did the same thing on both sides of the formula and then integrated. Of course, the two quantities were equal. But these two things together tell us that when we look at the left-hand side minus the right-hand side, that it goes to 0 as t goes to plus infinity. All right, so we have a linear function of t which goes to 0 as t goes to plus infinity. That means that linear function is just identically 0. And we're done. Okay, so any questions on that part? I mean, it'll be higher degree, exactly. It depends on the rank. And this is because we're in a rank one situation, we have a degree one polynomial. And that's how it goes. All right, so if you did SL3, you'd be dealing with quadratic polynomials, but still, this lets you control things because you have a good grip on these guys because of their polynomial nature. Now, the next phase of it is to select a good value of t. This part here is easier because we're working with PGL2. This phase of the argument is more complicated for a general group, but here it works rather nicely. We should simply go back to, I can't find it. Where's the definition of V? Here it is. That formula over there works for any T. All right, so we have actually a whole family of formulas, one for each T. But in reality, though, the formulas for equality between each side of the formula is actually just a linear function of T. And so you don't really have an infinite number of formulas because you have the equality of two linear polynomials. That just means the equality of their coefficients. So in some sense, in reality, we have two formulas written on the board when you just look at coefficients of the constant term and the linear term of the linear polynomial. So we really have two formulas. And one of them, in a sense, is just obtained in a sort of inductive way from the local trace formula on the split torus A. All right, so that is the split torus A is itself a reductive group, not an especially interesting one because it's a torus. But nevertheless, you have a Lie algebra trace formula on it, which just amounts to doing Fourier analysis on that additive group. It's not a complicated thing. And the in a sense, that formula gets one of the two formulas you get from this has to do with that, so it's not terribly interesting. So in essence, we really only have one formula that's interesting on the group itself, on PGL2. And the best way to clear out the mess is to just take T, since we only have one interesting formula in a sense, we should just select T to make this expression as simple as possible. And it's obvious how to do that. We take T to be negative 1/2 so that this cancels off with this and all that stuff just goes away. Okay, we're free to do that. So we just take, now take T equals negative 1/2 to simplify V sub M as much as possible. Well, it's really the V sub A that matters. The V sub G doesn't. It's always the same, doesn't matter. And that leads us to the final version. That's what I'll call the theorem. Of course, in a sense, the process doesn't stop here. Arthur goes on to make the local trace formula invariant. So that's, but this is the final form of the non-invariant local trace formula. There's nothing further you can do except make it invariant. So this is the theorem. Local trace formula on Lie algebra of PGL2. All right, so the local trace formula would become simpler because we made that expression V sub M simpler, and it simply now says J, since we're taking T to be minus a half, rather than write minus a half up there, I'll just write J. This is the thing you get. So we have J F1 F2 equals J F1 hat F2 check, where J is the thing you get by setting T equal to minus 1/2, like we just did. Okay, well, I should maybe write it out at this point. How strange, okay. Let me write out the final result in a couple of ways. All right, so so J is given by, for elliptic tori, what does it look like? We have a sum over elliptic T, and then stuff just basically like what you'd think from the violent integration formula. Nothing exciting happens here. F2, H inverse, adjoint action on H, dg dot dh dot dh. Now remember, there was a negative sign. It was t minus d of x and d of y. And that, because of that, we have a minus sign. And in the general case, you will find out an explanation for that. It has to do with minus 1 to the rank of a sub, to the dimension of a sub m. And then we have the Lie algebra of A. As usual, the discriminant. Then, again, for a while it's the same until we get to the weight factor. And here's the weight factor. We found out that it would be, we already took care of the minus sign, so it's going to be twice d of x plus twice d of y. With all the same conventions as usual as to what x and y mean. All right, so now we have these things called weighted orb literals coming in here. And in fact, again, this is special to the rank 1 case that it's this simple. In the rank 1 case, we simply have something plus something, and the first guy depends only on the first variable here, and the second guy only depends on the second variable here. So it splits up as a sum of something coming from having to do with F1 and something having to do with F2. In the higher rank case, there are things like that, but there are also kind of cross terms that make it more complicated that would already occur in rank 2. But in this case, we're lucky because we can simply, this is a sum, and so you can actually expand out this last term here. There's just, this happens for one torus, the split one. But this one term, you can think of it as being actually two terms, one of them where you have this, and then one of them where you have this. Once you've done that, you can just put that term involving x together with the term involving g that it goes with. And then we have a weighted orbital integral for F1 times, because this is an integral of the product. So we'll have a weighted orbital integral for F1 times an ordinary orbital integral for F2. And then when you look at the other thing, it's symmetrical, you will have also the other way around. When you use the d of y, you will have an ordinary orbital integral in the first variable and a weighted one in the second variable. And then in the elliptic stuff, there's no weighting going on. All right, that's the way you can sort of think about what comes out of all this stuff. Okay, so this is a weight factor. And when you have a weight factor like that appearing in your orbital integrals, then it's called a weighted orbital integral. Well, let me write it in a different way just to make the structure more transparent. I'm not really saying anything new now, just what I've already said in words, but now I want to write on the board in a more, in a way that's friendlier to the eye. Okay, so I'm just going to continue. J of F1, F2 is equal to this thing, and this thing is just basically just changing notation. We can write it as a sum over elliptic t, 1 over, as usual, order of the Weyl group. But it's an integral over t of, and now what I can do is, like Harish Chandra and Arthur usually do, rather than consider the orbital integral, we can renormalize it using the square root of the discriminant. Now the h is the same in both places, so we can just take the square root of the discriminant, we put it with this orbital integral, the other square root we put with this one, and just by definition, we call those things I. But I is for invariant integral, or orbital integral, or whatever. But it's, and I'll, at least here, I'll use notation very similar to that in Arthur's papers. All right, so these quantities I'm writing down are just the things that you have to define in order to make this be true. I'm just changing notation. I, h of F1 is exactly this integral, together with the square root of that. And then we have, I will do this thing of actually breaking it up into two for the last term. All right, so the The last term contributes two things, and one of them goes like this. One of them will have this invariant, this just plain orbital integral for F1. That's the one coming from the d of y term. But then the weighted orbital integral for F2. And the weighted orbital integral, in Arthur's papers, tend to get denoted by the letter j, and so that it doesn't look invariant anymore. I is for invariant, but j, well, it's not quite invariant. And again, to make the notation like in Arthur's papers, I'll put a sub a, so it tells what the weighting factor is, although for us it would just be a definition, a general principle. And then the symmetrical thing, or the thing that we need to make it symmetrical, just the other way around. So j a h f1 times the orbital integral for f2. So the question was, is it a coincidence that there are two terms here and that the order of the Weyl group is two? No, where? Where? That there's a two in the weight factor? So the question is whether it's a coincidence that the order of the Weyl group is two and there's a two here. I don't know. I mean, I think the answer is both yes and no. So maybe those cancel out and I won't answer it. in a way, the answer is yes. But I wouldn't want to try to generalize that immediately to higher rank groups, nevertheless. All right. So is it clear what I mean by this notation? The JAHF2 just comes from this integral, the square root of the discriminant thing, but you incorporate twice the d of the variable. All right. Now, what else do we need to do? We now have this, we have this trace formula, and we should use it for something. And although I gave these references at the beginning of the lecture, and in a sense alluded to them because of those facts, one and fact two, that we needed to use, in a sense, it's really now that I want to make a comment in a serious way about things that occurring in these papers I mentioned, the admissible invariant distribution, the Queen's paper one that where the expanded version with complete proofs occurred in this version. The other one has summaries of proofs, or some proofs are omitted. One of the main theorems in there we can prove now as an application. Well, of course, we can only do it for PGL2, but we can prove one of the main theorems in there, one of the really hard parts of that, we can prove as an application of the local trace formula. So this is an illustration of why this point of view of local trace formula is useful. It lets you prove something that before was harder to prove, and in some sense harder to understand how the proof was working, whereas now you sort of see it in a natural context, and it's easier to think about. All right, and here I'm going to be following Vols-Berger. And in fact, well, let me write down, oh, we need notation. Then I'll formulate the result. And I'll comment on what's due to Harsh-Chandran and what's due to Vols-Berger in a minute. The extra bit of notation is I want to write G sub E for the set of elliptic elements. This is a subset of the regular semi-simple elements. And I'll write, regular RS for regular semisimple. The ones that are elliptic are the ones where the centralizer is an elliptic torus. If you have a regular semisimple element, its centralizer is a maximal torus. And there's two possibilities in In PGL2, either the thing's split or the thing is compact. And the elliptic ones is where it's compact. But it's a general definition. So this is actually X in regular semi-simple, such that the centralizer in G of X is an elliptic maximal torus. It'll be a maximal torus, but the condition is that the maximal torus be elliptic, be compact mob the center. Now here's the theorem, which it's a general theorem, but we haven't discussed yet the weight factors in general, so I can't formulate it generally. It is a general theorem. The theorem, mostly it was proved by Harsh Chandra by these more complicated means in the Queen's paper. But one part of it, the part relating to the specific values where we get some weighted orbital integrals, this part occurs in the paper by Vols-Verger that I cited a couple times ago. Okay, so let's take a... there's room for it. Almost made a terrible mistake there. Take a function phi, which is locally constant compact and supported on the elliptic set. All right, that's a very strong condition on its support. That means it's zero on all hyperbolic elements, all things conjugate to something in the split torus, for example. I should note GE, the elliptic set, that's something open. The regular semi-simple set is open. This is open in there. That means it's a nice subset. It's open in the locally compact topology. It's not Zariski open, but it's just open in the classical topology. So we take a function which is whose support is compact and contained in there. That makes it a very special kind of thing. Then I want to write down an invariant distribution, and I'm going to write down the formula for it. It depends on the phi. So we're going to write down an invariant distribution on the Lie algebra. So it's got a test function, and then we have to specify the value of the distribution on the test function. Okay, so take the test function f. This distribution, we'll call it I sub phi. I is because it's going to be invariant, but phi because it depends on phi. And then what is it on this test function? Here's the definition. We integrate over the group. We integrate over the Lie algebra. We take our test function. We integrate it against our function phi in the same kind of way that we do in the local trace formula. That's why we're going to be able to get information about it. When we derived the local trace formula, we did exactly this. This is, as usual, the adjoint action. So that's the conjugate of x by G inverse. Now, when we wrote down the kernel function that we were studying on the group, it looked like that. When we took the Lie algebra analog, the kernel function exactly looked, well, get rid of this, but it looked like this. And so now you should object that we're doing exactly the thing that we weren't supposed to do. Because if I don't put this integral over G in here, that's the Lie algebra analog of our kernel. And I said before, you can't integrate it over G. That's why we had to truncate it. So you should say, well, wait a minute. We shouldn't be able to integrate it over G. But you have to remember that this function is very special. That's why it's valid. If we tried to do that for an arbitrary phi, we couldn't do it. But for these special phis, it makes sense. That's part of the theorem. Okay, so this thing here makes sense. That's the first. The integral is convergent after all. And, once it makes sense, we have this distribution, and it's easy to see then, just you conjugate it, you see it's an invariant distribution, this part's easy, is an invariant distribution. And also, again, by the formula, you see that it's supported on this elliptic set. Let me try to say what the general nature of this thing is. What we're doing here is we're using phi to tell us, well, the way you should think about this thing is it's something built up out of the orbital integrals of f. All right, this is a distribution. F is the test function. This invariant distribution is a kind of integral of orbital integrals for conjugacy classes coming from elements that are in the support of phi. Okay, this is a kind of smeared out version. It's not a single orbital integral because this, I mean, you cannot take phi to be a delta function at some that's what you'd sort of like to do intuitively. Take an elliptic regular semi-simple element. We would like to take the delta function at that point. Well, of course, we could take the characteristic function of some tiny neighborhood of it. But still, you'll end up, that'll still meet nearby conjugacy classes. And so this thing here is a way of looking at all the orbital integrals for not just that point, but for the ones near it. And in general, okay, you have some function, and this is a smeared out version of elliptic regular semi-simple orbital integrals. That's the nature of it. That's the first statement. And then, okay, I'm not going to be able to prove this, but at least I will finish writing the statement, and then we'll come back to it next time. Okay, so that was not the interesting part. That's just saying that the thing is some reasonable object. But the interesting part is B. What we need to show, this is the main theorem I was referring to, one of the main theorems in Harsh-Chandra's Queen's paper, one of the main technical parts of doing it, was to show that when we take the Fourier transform of this particular invariant distribution, that distribution is actually a function. Okay, some distributions are functions, some aren't. If you take an orbital integral, that's not a function. That distribution is far from being a function. But when we take the Fourier transform of this guy, it is a function. This part is due to Harsh-Chandra. The Fourier transform, I phi hat of I phi. So maybe parenthetically over here, suppose you've got a distribution B. As usual, what do you mean by the distribution D hat, the Fourier transform? Just like on the case of Rn, Euclidean space, it's the same thing. I mean, by definition, the Fourier transform on test function F is, just the definition, D of F hat. But it's, of course, just like in the real case, it's the obvious extension of the notion of Fourier transform of functions to the Fourier transform of distributions. It's compatible with the classical notion in the case that the distribution is a function. The Fourier transform of this distribution is represented by the following locally L1 function, locally integrable. Locally L1 function. Locally integrable function, it's a class function. It's conjugation invariant on the regular semi-simple set. It's a locally L, well, no, I should, that's actually a poor way to say it. I mean, it's locally L1 on G, all right? We're not going to define it as, it's just like these orbital integrals we have. We will actually have a function defined only on the regular semi-simple set. If you like, extend it by zero to all the singular elements. But it's locally L1 function on G. That's a way stronger statement than to say on G regular semi-simple. In other words, I'm not taking that distribution and restricting it to the open subset G regular semi-simple. Then it would be very easy to show that that's a function. The hard thing is to show it's a function regarded as a distribution on G, not on the open set G regular semi-simple. So I should put it, comma, locally constant on G regular semisimple, and in some sense not even defined except on regular semisimple. But here's what it is. You get a beautifully simple result. I'll have to discuss the significance of it next time, but let me just finish writing it. And I think maybe next time I'll write down, I'll just say in words, I mean, this is the orbital integral for y, okay? And here, this is the weighted orbital integral for y. Now, you may say I already had those things, because I had the I and the j, but not exactly, because the I and j incorporated the square root of the discriminant function. Here, we don't put the square root of the discriminant in. This is the orbital integral without the normalizing factor. This is the weighted orbital integral without the normalizing factor. Well, I'm going to go over just a hair more, because I want to say which part is due to Harish-Chandra and which part to Walsh-Frege. Harish-Chandra proved that this thing is a locally L1 function, and he proved that on the elliptic set it was given by this thing. But as I mentioned before, you won't see weighted orbital integrals, and so you won't see this last part. The point is, once you replace orbital integrals by weighted orbital integrals, somehow it's the same statement. Here it was the orbital integrals of this function, Fourier transform of phi, and here it's simply, then it turns out that the weighted orbitals have a real meaning. They just, they answer this natural question. So notice here, there's no weighted orbital integrals being put in there artificially. This is a natural question where we have a smeared out version of elliptic orbital integrals, but you find out when you take the Fourier transform and look at what function you get, the weighted orbital integrals are forced upon you. They answer that question. Okay, so that's where I'll stop for today.